Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shayna Appel.
And he is Chris Owen. We are the podcast attempting to reclaim the public narrative, freeing it from the binaries of politics and economics, which dominate so much of the conversation in our public square, but which does precious little to shine a light on matters of human flourishing. And if we cannot speak, address, lift up, name, reach for issues of human flourishing, then the question remains, how will we actually get there?
Our method is to bring the lenses of theology and moral philosophy as a way to look at our shared common life and public questions. So our podcast is an exercise in just that very idea. We take public questions and we put it through the What in God's Name Tumblr.
We put it in the cocktail shaker, add a twist of orange and a cherry, and voila.
And out comes what we hope is a more interesting and more fruitful way of seeing our shared common life. We hope that we achieve some agreement, but we aim for more interesting disagreement. We don't think that what we do is just going to lead to unity, but we do think it can lead to more fruitful, more productive, as I say, Shayna, more fruitful and productive disagreement.
We record, we live, we reside in southern New Hampshire, land of the Swamp Yankees. And in that spirit, Chris, in his spare time, went out and created for us a spinny wheel. A spinny wheel, an actual bicycle wheel bolted to a piece of plywood with a sprinkler head taped to it. You should go to our website sometime and check out a picture of it. But this thing actually exists. On it are areas that define certain core ideas that we like to explore and go deep into.
Shayna, it's time to spin the wheel.
Excellent, Chris. Give it a go.
The spinny wheel has landed on plural, one of our key concepts as we talk about our shared common life.
I think it really points to and lifts up for us. It reminds us that binaries, you know, either this or that, dominate so much of reality in our public square. The reality, in fact, I think I can speak for both of us on this, we believe that multiple ideas can be true and exist simultaneously. So, you know, our capacity to think as pluralists can be very helpful and maybe even at the core of what identifies us as Americans, I would say even. That it's a cornerstone of democracy, the ability to hold multiple ideas simultaneously.
Yeah, my take on plural that I want to offer today is one of the dangers of advocating for a theological perspective into the public square is that sometimes certain expressions of religion and theology can look at pluralism as a weakness. And I want to say, our show wants to say, our project wants to say, that not only is pluralism a feature of our shared common life in the United States that we value, but even more, Shayna, I want to say pluralism is a theological value, that the God that I know and understand and love values, lifts up, has in that God's very heart, an embrace of diversity and difference. So it's not, pluralism is not just something we tolerate, it's of God's heart.
From the Christian tradition, isn't it written in Scripture that, you know, in Christ we are no longer slave nor free, Jew nor Gentile, male nor female, but we are all one in God's creation. Going back to the book of Genesis, you know, we see just a really very diverse effort on God's part in this process of creation. I mean, I always laugh and say, you know, if it had been up to me, if I could have come up with bird, If I could have come up with something that flew, like I would have been so excited, I would have quit there. But God didn't quit there. God didn't create one bird. God created multiple birds. And on that note,
that is our sound effect to indicate that we are moving from the spinny wheel to the content of today's show. Today's show is a retrospective wrap-up of the question we asked all our guests this fall. That question being, what are you grieving about our shared common life? We're going to replay our four guests' answers to that question. Each answer is about 4 minutes long. And then Shana and I will reflect on what we've heard, key phrases, an idea that popped for either Shana or me. And we want you, our listening community, to do the same. As you listen again to our respondents, what resonates with you? And Shana, I thought we'd do this in groups of two. So we'll play two in a row, and then you and I will jump in and reflect on them, and then we'll do the last two and do the same. How does that sound to you?
Sounds groovy. Let's do it.
So first, this first one is Alyssa Rossoff. Alyssa is the humanist chaplain at the women's prison in North Carolina. Alyssa, of course, is responding to the question, what do you grieve in our shared common life? If you'd like to hear the full conversation with Alyssa, it is show number 509 that dropped on December 1st, 2022. So this is me and Alyssa. Alyssa, you obviously are awake to the world. You're awake to suffering. You're a person who has compassion and exercises compassion in your professional work. And so it is of value to pose the question to you, not just as a prison chaplain, but as an awake person looking at the world. And especially for the purposes of our show, we don't look at the wide, wide world. We look at America. We're interested in the culture that we're in now, the culture and the society, our shared public life. And so the question really is, as you look at American society, what do you grieve about it? What sense of loss might you feel as you look at our shared common life?
I think a lot of it has to do with binary thinking, and that there is this phrase that came to me in seminary at Union Theological Seminary, which is queering the binary. What I mean by that in this context is, how can we, first of all, name these self and other and we, them binaries in order to understand them? Where did they come from? Why are we living like this in an extremely segregated society still? And how we can move toward dissolving that binary. And that doesn't mean getting rid of uniqueness and identity by any means. And so I think sometimes people kind of swing too far in the opposite direction by saying, well, we should all be colorblind. No, that's not going to solve anything, because then that erases the uniqueness of different people's identities, and that uniqueness is of great value. But rather, how can we learn about the other? How can we become educated so that irrational fears can be dissolved that are not founded upon anything except for rhetoric that's not based upon fact? I do think if you really boil it down, it's just about little interactions throughout the day. And so that's the imminent with an I. That's the going to the grocery store, someone who looks different from you or speaks different from you or dresses different, whatever, is making small talk with you and you get to know them as a person. Or You know, just being aware how little waving to someone in your neighborhood or choosing not to wave and look in the other direction as they walk toward you, which is something that has happened to my husband a lot as a man of color in a predominantly white neighborhood, the huge impact that makes. And so what would it look like to become more aware of these small micro, and I don't want to say microaggression as if I'm, you know, pointing fingers at people, but these little micro actions that people choose to make or they happen unconsciously, really becoming aware of those. And that probably stems from my study of Buddhism, to be honest. Like, how can I minimize suffering? And sometimes, quote unquote, right speech is knowing when to not say anything at all. And so just, you know, if we could just start to get to know the people around us better. And that's really how I try to make sense of it. And that's not a big Capitol Hill sweeping policy change, but I do think something like that is what is needed for people to open up a bit more.
That was Alyssa Rossoff. Next up is Brad Littlejohn. Brad is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and the founder of the Davenant Institute. If you'd like to hear the full conversation with Brad, it's show 517, and it dropped on February 2nd, 2023. Here is me and Brad Littlejohn. Do you have a couple more minutes? Because I'd love to pivot to this last question. I would love to ask you what we've been asking all of our guests this fall, which is, what are you grieving? What do you feel a sense of loss about with regards to our shared common life? Do you have time to answer that one?
Yeah, I can answer it briefly because I think I've kind of already touched on it, which I think it is this inability to distinguish friends and foes. I think I would say, you know, we do need to have the category of foe. It's always important to remember our struggle is not with flesh and blood, but with principalities and powers. But, you know, principalities and powers, that doesn't mean that principalities and powers don't use flesh and blood instruments. I don't think Paul is not saying, you know, you're not in any way fighting with flesh and blood. He's just saying, remember that the kind of the deep structure of the battle is elsewhere. So I think, yeah, there are people that are, you know, enemies of the, it's possible to be an enemy of the faith. Paul calls people, you know, the apostles call people out for being enemies of the faith. I think there, it's possible in politics, someone to be an enemy of the common good. And so there are foes that we need to fight against. We are, as I said, the list of our true foes is always, I think, you know, usually much shorter than we imagine it to be. And there are many people that could be friends that we turn into foes by a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. And a lot of it comes to what I said of being unable to distinguish between differences over ends and differences over means. If we can't, you know, like, I mean, this was on display in so many ways during the whole COVID situation, is people took extremely polarized positions on what were appropriate policies. And my effort was constantly to try to drill down and say, okay, are we disagreeing on the principles in question? Or are we disagreeing about the facts on the ground? Or are we disagreeing about the right way to cash out the principles in light of the facts on the ground? And because if we are agreeing on the principles in question about, you know, what the Christian's responsibility is to protect the life of his neighbor, but, you know, but also all these other goods about the importance of human relationship and you know, that there is a good in the government protecting the lives of its citizens, but there's also a good in the government giving its citizens space to make their own decisions. You know, like, can we agree on all these goods and then say, well, but we still disagree about in practice maybe the right way to balance them, because we might have different assessments of the facts on the ground and so on. Like, if we can do that, then we can live together. Like, we can still live together, even though we have some maybe sharply different ideas of the right policy approach. But if we can't distinguish those, and if it's like, oh, you know, you don't care about you don't care about life, or you don't care about freedom, or you don't care about you know, you don't care about protecting the elderly, or you don't care about kids being able to be in school. You know, it's like, well, like, anyway, we just demonized one another through that whole thing, and it's just we do it in so many other things. By failing to ask this question of where are we disagreeing over ends and where are we disagreeing over means. So yes, that's what grieves me, and that's what I'm constantly working on, and it seems to be a thankless task.
That's such an interesting pairing, Chris, because, you know, I mean, you've got Alyssa Rossoff, who's a humanist chaplain working in prisons, and then you've got Brad Littlejohn, who is I'd put him more in the conservative Christian faith tradition. And here they are. So did you hear anything that tied them together in ways that might surprise us?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because I did. And so check me out on this, Shana, and our listening community, if I misheard. But I think, see, here's what I think they have in common, which is both of them talk about divisions in American society. And they start at opposite ends, which I'll explain in a second. And they qualify their starting point, and in the qualification that they offer to their starting point, each of them ends up closer to each other than they do at the beginning. So they start from opposite ends, and I'm not saying they meet in the middle, but they're pointing towards a common ground in the middle.
They travel towards a common ground.
So let me just lift that up in a more concrete way. Alyssa, our humanist chaplain at the women's prison, she starts with what she grieves is binary thinking. And what she means in that is, she says, self and other, the binary of self and other, or the binary of we and them. So this strict divide between people. And then she says, her qualification is, yeah, we should not think in those binary terms, but she says, we shouldn't get rid of uniqueness and identity. So that's her qualification. The opposite end, where Brad starts, is with, he says, what he grieves is our inability to identify friend and foe. So he starts with the problem of being, we don't have enough of the binary. We need more binary. We need to be able to identify friend and foe. But then he qualifies it by saying, oftentimes our list of foes is much longer than it needs to be. We don't, so his whole qualification is like, we don't do enough work in discerning where we actually might have common ground. And so he starts with this, yeah, we need the binary, but we need to discern better where we might have common ground. Alyssa starts with unity, but we can't lose individuality. And so she moves from, you get what I'm saying.
I do. I'm wondering.
I hope I've characterized that.
You did. You really did it brilliantly, as usual. You pulled something out that I didn't see, but I think is so spot on. I'm wondering, do you think where you start off in that conversation impacts where you end up, and if so, how?
Wow, that is a tremendous question, Shana.
Every once in a while, I come up with one. Usually that's your job, but every once in a while.
Oh, man, I hope, first of all, let me say this. I hope our listening community just pauses on that question, because I think it's profound.
Does where you start, i.e., if you start at the center, work your way out, versus if you start at the outside, work your way back towards the center, if you start by lifting up the divisions, or if you start at the non-binary, does it impact where you end up?
I think it does. But I'd be hard-pressed to say exactly how.
Because I'm thinking that, this is where my head went, when you were sort of laying all that out, I started to think, in a world, because I'm in Alyssa's camp. I tend to start at, you know, sure, we all have stuff in common. We can find the common. And I am one to constantly rail against the binary. That having been said, there are places where we must, for our safety, I think, and our sanity, identify people with whom we cannot and will not agree, activities that we will not support. I don't extend the binary to, what's the word I'm looking for, to relativity, you know, to absolute relativity, where everything is everything. And that probably reveals more about my age than I wish it did, my generation. I do think there are ultimate truths. But I will start at a common point and give a person or an idea sort of every benefit of the doubt until I get to the place where I have to say, yeah, no, I can't. Or as Jesus put it so eloquently to his disciples, you know, don't cast your pearls before swine. Like, you just have to know that you have so much time, you have so much energy, you have so much you can do. Where do you say yes? Where do you say no? Whereas my thinking is, obviously I have no idea if what I'm about to say is true or not, because I don't live in this camp. But I think if you start off in a place of divisiveness, and try to then figure out, you know, so then aren't we back to sort of puritanical Christianity? Like, so who are in fact the elect? Who is going to be admitted into the gates of heaven while the rest of the parish goes to hell in a handbasket? You know, are you likely to find more division if you start from a place of division? Are you likely to find more commonality if you start in a place of commonality? I guess that's my lingering question.
Yeah.
Does that give you more to think about?
Well, it does. I think your response and the way you're thinking about this points to that there are dangers both ways. If you start with divisiveness, you just named it, the danger would be a puritanical judgmentalism. If you start with there's no difference and you know we're all one, then you miss places where, I'll just put it in this way, where there's genuine evil that needs to be resisted. That's not your language, but I'm just putting it out there as a way to conceive this. Like,
well, it's not my language. I mean, there is evil.
That's not the word you used. Evil. But evil in the way I'm using it stands for those things.
The lynching of George Floyd, the lynching of Tyre Nichols, and I mean, the list goes on. There are places where I would say no. No, now I can.
And that's, I those are the places where judgment is needed, right?
Judgment is needed, and we shouldn't stop at judgment.
Yeah.
Like, we can stop at judgment and just say, okay, well, those were really bad people, so let's throw them in jail and not look at the bigger problems that contributed to that. That's the, you know, that's the malleable center. But yeah, the behavior itself absolutely is unacceptable. There is no excuse, not ever. Not ever. So, again, I mean, I'm going to try. I will always be a person who starts in the space of trying to find commonality, but don't don't was it a George Bushism? Don't misunderestimate me. Don't fool yourself into thinking I'm some, you know, liberal ass pansy over here who's not gonna throw down if throwing down becomes necessary, because I will throw down.
That was so good. I think the larger picture, if we just back out of this for a second, what I found in common between Alyssa's and Brad's response to the question of grief is the whole cluster of ideas and human experience about division, division in our society, and how do we negotiate? I mean, you've said it beautifully already, but how do we negotiate where there needs to be necessary division, distinction, and where can we, and where does a certain kind of binary way of thinking keep us separate in unnecessary ways? And there's no, there's no final answer to this. It's just we have to continue to wrestle with. That's part of our project. Is like,
right.
We are wrestling with this. We want to raise it as a question. Help people be conscious of the ways that these dynamics can play out.
Right. We said we wanted to get beyond the binary. We never said we wanted to, you know, absolutely, excoriate it. We never said that we wanted to do away with it. We just wanted to be able to get beyond it, you know, so that the binary is not the only, you know, thing that there is, i.e. you're either with us or against us. Well, there are probably cases in where those absolutes are true, but more often than not, even those of us who disagree vehemently about something can find some common agreement. You actually put these together well, and I'm really grateful for your thinking about, you know, where they came together and where they parted.
Thank you for your thank you. You're welcome, I guess, would be the proper response. Let's do our second group of two, Shana. This is me and Tim Peebles, Mennonite pastor, teacher, and theologian. If you want to hear the whole conversation with Tim, that's show number 513, and it dropped on January 6th, 2023. Here is me and Tim. Tim, I'm really grateful that, first of all, that I found you through the through the wonderful internet, and I've been grateful for the conversations that we've been able to have. And so I want to ask you, as we turn towards a closing here, as you turn your outer eyes and also your inner eyes, the eyes of your heart, out into American society and culture, what do you grieve in our shared common life? We're asking this question in the spirit of really paying attention to those words, like grieving. It's not just a shorthand for what don't you like, but what, if you can share with us, what are you grieving in our shared common life?
Well, an aspect of my faith journey that maybe has been hinted at, but not explicitly named. I come from white working class backgrounds. You know, if you had taken me from my early years and dropped me into today's time, I would be a Christian nationalist, a Trump supporter without any serious reservations, I think. And because I have that heritage and that history, I have a sense of empathy for folks who are in that mode of political engagement. I think it's, just to be clear, pretty dangerous and deadly for healthy democracy and culture. And we need to engage in forms of harm reduction or containing that harm as much as possible. But I think one of the ways that we minimize that harm is by extending some empathy and some compassion to folks. That's easier for me because that's what I come from. And so one of the things I feel sad about, and it's an ambivalent kind of sadness because, you know, I look at that, the white privilege that's built into that, and think that's not a good and beautiful thing. But there's also a working class struggle that's built into that. Folks who are working really hard to make ends meet and are one paycheck away from not being able to do so. I feel a real sadness that a pattern of life that made sense and provided a kind of coherence for people has eroded and is now under threat. To be clear, again, I think that pattern of life does need to change, does need to be eroded, does need to be replaced by something more life-giving. But when people are going through those kinds of changes, it is very disorienting and frightening and scary. And it has real existential impact when your livelihood is wrapped up in it. And so I'm still trying to sort out how I maintain a criticism of how working class white folks have still bought into white supremacy, and that needs to be criticized, while at the same time saying the economic precarity that they are in is a legitimate human suffering that needs to be acknowledged and appreciated. It's not uniquely theirs. All of the precarity of working class white folks are pervasively shared by non-white folks in our society. And so it's not just them, but it does include them in a way that I think has often gone unacknowledged and unnoticed. And so I feel a kind of sadness about that suffering and lack of attention to it, the failure of church to do anything positively with it. I think the form of Christianity that I grew up with largely just rubber stamps that and accepts that status quo, redirects legitimate class frustrations into sort of spiritualized acceptance. So there's some kind of sadness, probably in the form of lament, that I have with that, that that's not the way things are supposed to be.
That was Tim Peebles. Next up is me and Alishia Keys Harris. She is a learning specialist at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. If you'd like to hear the full conversation with Alishia, that's show number 505, and it dropped on October 16th, 2022. After we listen to Alishia, Shana and I will jump back in and do a little reflection on what we've heard from Tim Peebles and Alishia. It's the question we're asking everybody, and I'll tell you why we're asking it after I ask it. The question is, what are you grieving in our shared common life? What do you feel we have lost? And when I say feel we have lost, I don't mean think, but like, what do you feel has been lost? And the reason we're asking it is not to wallow in this sense of grief, sadness, loss, but the hypothesis is that when we can identify what we have lost, we're on the road to identifying what we love. And that's ultimately where we want to go in our conversations with people. So, will you answer that question?
You know, when he asked me initially and asked me, what was I grieving? And I said, you know, I had to think about it. Actually, I had to go back and define grief, you know, get really like go and find the Merriam-Webster version of what is grief? And it's the suffering of a loss. So, of course, I agree to that. I agree that that exists. And I agree that I'm aware of, like, you know, our circumstances, I should say. What am I thought about this as we came up to this very moment. And to be honest, I grieve so many things that there probably isn't a single thing that I don't. So, and I say that because there are so many, because I feel so connected to people, you know, typically quickly, that as a follower of Christ, I feel that this is one of the biggest pains for me is that Christianity is a noun for some people. And when it is actually a verb, and I got this because I'm over in Abu Dhabi, and the lady says to me, Jesus never asked you to be a Christian. Well, he never said that. She goes, I know, I've read. And I was like, you know what? That's a good thing. Like we've turned this into something to be instead of a way of being, instead of a way of doing, when the directions were specific to follow me. And then that would take you trying to figure out what he wants you to follow. That would take study. And that would be some of the things that people are against, you know, or not necessarily against, but they feel that it's not necessary. And as an educator myself, that hurts me to the core, because if I'm telling you, you could use these one things to survive from the word, we can have many arguments over the validity of it, how much of it is true, how much of it is a whimsical story. But at the end of the day, and I thought Brandon and I have had many conversations about that, that at the end of the day, it's good for improvement. It's good for study. It's good for where you need to go. So if in fact you're trying to make these vertical movements, you know, the word is there for you for that. And if we're not versing ourselves in it, then who are we following? Because if we're not following Christ and we're not reading what he wants us to follow, then who exactly are we following? And what is being a Christian? Why is it a thing? And why is it not a verb? Why is it not? And it's something that we have to do constantly. We have to do it every day. So I do grieve that. I grieve that Christianity is a thing as opposed to. Yeah. So I want to say that that's the biggest one. And with that, you can see how the unwillingness to learn and study is impacting everything. Politics, education, faith, everything. It's, yeah.
Those were such good conversations. It was nice to be reminded of the depth and breadth of those. Curious, Chris, because you were the one who came up with the question initially. What did you hear in their responses that got you thinking, that got you, you know, being curious and going deep?
So when I listened to Tim again, something popped out at me, Shana, that I didn't hear the first time around. And he didn't actually say this, but I think it's a key component of a grief that lives in our public life these days, and it pops out in various ways. But so he was talking about the loss of meaningful work in the white working class, because he relates to that demographic through his upbringing, as do I, by the way. I resonate with this as well, having grown up in the Steel Belt in Ohio, which is now, of course, the Rust Belt. So that's my own personal connection to what Tim was saying. But what I heard this time around that he didn't say exactly, but it's the crisis of masculinity that is in our culture, and it rears itself in many unhealthy ways. But this, so the sense of work and meaningful work, and the loss of that, and the loss of that. And again, we noted this before. I'll just say this one other thing and have your response. But this is another thing that I think is lacking in our public life. But his ability to, at the same time, hold intention, compassion, and also critique. And we do that poorly in our culture. So I guess I've said two different things, but would love to have your thoughts.
Well, I think part of why he's able to hold compassion and critique is because he's actually done the work of spiritual growth. And I think, you know, the inability to be critically reflective of self is largely the problem of people who are still carrying around the same mindsets as they did when they were adolescents. So, you know, if we don't commit and engage in that kind of spiritual growth, then what are we going to, like, what is the new ground we're standing on to reflect on the prior, or how do we see, you know, the ground that somebody else is on if we haven't done our own work? And yeah, I know we talked a lot about the feeling among masses of Americans that life is empty and meaningless. And this was something that we reflected on from two Atlantic magazine articles. And both of them concluded that, you know, when we stand in that place where our lives don't seem to have any meaning, when we as a nation, as a people, or even as a world community are not being called to something larger, then what ends up happening is a high degree of boredom. So that is toxic. I mean, it is absolutely toxic. And then you throw into that mix the whole current schemata of masculinity in America, and it's in a transition, right? It's in a transition, but men have not really been enculturated to come together and talk about these sorts of things. Men don't process, right, as a general rule. So where are those conversations happening? I mean, yeah, there are pockets, obviously. There's men's support groups. There's, you know, groups of guys who get together. But, and I've asked this question, I think I've said this to you any number of times on the show, you know, the number of times I have wondered, like, where the hell are all the good guys? Like, I know a lot of good guys, and I wonder, where the hell are they in the process of speaking to other boys in a way that women can't? You know, in the same way that black people will say to white people, look, we, you know, white supremacy ain't our illness. It's yours. You have to address it. And I feel like the same thing is true for men. I mean, your liberation has got to be bound up in your liberation. It has to be seen as, you know, this ancient way of being has been confining and limiting all the way around, and it's not serving anyone. Why don't we take the lid off it and see, you know, what's available to explore? And I agree with you that Tim didn't say it, but I think it could absolutely be in the waft of, you know, the weave there in what he was saying. You want to go on to Allie?
I do, and I actually want to connect them because my...
I was hoping you were going to do that.
Yeah, my... What I intuit, maybe it was explicit, but in both of their responses, Tim's less so, Alicia's was more direct, she laments a certain way of expressing Christianity into our culture. She characterized it as Christianity as a noun instead of a verb. Christianity, in my language, as identity rather than as discipleship or following Christ. And Tim alluded to certain failures of modern day American Christianity to address the more fundamental question that he was raising about the white working class and the crisis of masculinity that I'm throwing in as an addition. But the commonality there between the two is a critique of some expressions of Christianity in America today. Now, my reflection is, yes, that is true. And it is lamentable because I think, and this is a piece of our project, we need to model a healthy, life-affirming Christianity into the public square. Some people will say, let's get rid of religion and keep it out of the public square. It's so toxic, we can't, there's nothing there that's redeemable. And I just push back against that's what we push back against. But there are plenty of examples of how Christianity can be and is unhealthy. So to some, I noted their critique of current Christian practices in our culture.
That's a great connector, Chris. And I think it's also interesting how, you know, the critique that they would offer on Christianity because of the types, the brands of Christianity that they came from, right? The sects that they come from would be very different from, for example, the the lament that I may lift up about Christianity in the public square. You know, as someone who has traveled, you know, within circles of progressive Christianity, my lament is we're too damn quiet. Their lament has to do more with the extent to which their folks have, you know, shot out, they have sort of sucked the oxygen out of the public square with an assumption that, with assumptions that are not held, even by all of their own people. It does make me feel good that, you know, that we're all able to be critical about the areas in which we're failing. But it also, and, you know, our listeners can absolutely feel free to blow back on me on this, but it is, I firmly believe that the decline in people's pursuing a faithful identity, and I'll come back and I'll come back and say more about that in a minute, but the decline in that, and the rise in incivility and intolerance, if you were to map it out on a timeline, you would absolutely see a correlation. And what I mean by pursuing a spiritual identity, because that, in my worldview, is something that can be done in a lot of different ways. But there are some points of constancy across all of the paths that one might take. And those are things like an appreciation of something bigger than just us, a commitment to something bigger than just us, a willingness to sacrifice for that bigger thing, a core humility that knows we will not be the whole, we will never be all that we can be in this lifetime right up until the moment when we die, that, you know, we should be pursuing and trying to become better people for ourselves, for our loved ones, for our communities, and for the world. There is absolutely nothing we are doing today that we cannot do better. And I think those are sort of, you know, those cornerstones of a spiritual path. And then beyond that, of course, there is, you know, I would suggest that anyone on a spiritual path, a healthy spiritual path, must absolutely demonstrate concern for those at the margins. Many churches are failing to live into that. And there are people who are preaching vitriol from pulpits in, you know, congregations across denominations, and other people who are showing up week in and week out to listen to it. So I don't mean to say that the cure to all evils is everyone must go to church, but I think the cure to all evils is that we should all be on some sort of a spiritual journey, have some sort of a community of accountability, and absolutely be able to demonstrate good works that are building up our world and the people around us. Thanks for opening that up, though. That was a good rant.
Oh, yeah.
I feel better.
Excellent. Excellent. Oh, goodness.
Thanks for going deep.
Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
Yep, and shine light. Our show today is brought to you by our generous donors on Patreon. You can join our generous donors on Patreon and keep these kinds of conversations going. Go to patreon.com. We send our thanks again to our guests this fall, Alishia Keys-Harris, Alyssa Rossoff, Brad Littlejohn, and Tim Peebles, and for their response to this question: what are you grieving in our shared common life? You can sign up for our newsletter at our website, whatingods.com, which is a little tricky to do on Zoom, but Shana, it is
whatingods.
And Shana, so good to be with you today.
Always good to be with you, Chris. I will see you when I get back from vacation.